is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine crisis. I welcome Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft to comment on the tumbling headlines derived from the concern that Russia is escalating the conflict from the battle space to all of NATO, to all of the world, mentioning nuclear weapons. These headlines come from Moscow, however, suggesting there's turmoil. Putin's call-up brings reality of war home to many Russians. We see photographs, we presume from Moscow, of young people being carried away by the authorities, by police in dark helmets, protesting the Ukrainian conflict. We also have this: Ukraine frees Putin ally in swap deal for hundreds of troops, and Ukraine latest prisoners released EU's next sanctions goals, and Ukraine seizes dozens of Russian tanks left by fleeing forces. Turmoil following remarks of a partial mobilization, the modifier is critical here, by Vladimir Putin and the Duma. At the same time, reports of young people, young men, fleeing or exiting Moscow at exorbitant prices. I had one quote that it was $5,000 one way from Moscow to Istanbul on an aircraft leaving Russia, leaving behind their families, leaving behind their mortgages and their car loans. This is profoundly disruptive to Russian life that is already under strain because of the sanctions. Anatole, a very good day to you. I could go on, as you know, with disorder around the world. Important thing to come to right now is your presentation and remarks to CNN that it is important to Vladimir Putin to move this story from one of Russian aggression against a neighboring sovereign state, Ukraine, to Russia defending the motherland. Why is that important to Vladimir Putin? And did he achieve that in his brief address to the Russian people? Good evening to you.
Hello, John. Well, it's critical to Putin for two reasons. The first is to cover up his own mistakes, because, you know, Russia's failures and the failures of the Russian government and planning in Ukraine have been, you know, colossal and are now absolutely obvious. And to say that, you know, Russia is not fighting Ukraine, but is, or not Ukraine alone, but is fighting the whole of the West, I mean, that obviously makes it the Russian failure easier to swallow, easier to excuse if Russia, you know, if Russia is facing a huge coalition of powerful enemies. So that's the first thing, to find excuses for Russian failure. I mean, by the way, of course, there's an element of truth in it. The West is massively arming Ukraine, and not just that, but America is providing critical intelligence and training and everything else. But the second reason is to try to mobilize Russian feeling, especially, you know, support for the war, patriotism, especially, of course, now that he is having to mobilize, you know, call up previous classes of conscripts, which, you know, more and more military planners in Russia and hardliners are saying he should have done at the very beginning of the war, or rather before the war. And but the reason he didn't is very clear, as we see from the protests in Moscow and the masses of young men trying to flee Russia. You know, Putin was afraid to declare mass mobilization because he thought that that might finally produce a real public backlash against him in Russia, which is what it is doing.
Yes, I'm told these are statistics. I'm told that the way that it was presented, partial mobilization, looking for young men who have some training in the military, reservists they're called, and some special training, that is radio operators or drive a truck, and that the agreed number is there are 25 million eligible, and the number 300,000 is used, although I'm told that's not a fixed number. This is a moving story. The Duma has moved to pass legislation punishing anyone severely who either flees the draft or dissents in some fashion, or so-called deserters. All of that introduces my youth, Anatole. I want to mention it. My youth was protest of the Vietnam War, and it's striking to see the photographs from Moscow of young people being carried off, reminding me exactly, although the photographs were black and white in the 1960s and 70s, of young people being carried off, say, from the Pentagon or from protesting in front of the Congress building. So they're going through the same disorder that America went through. And America's disorder led to changes of direction by the Johnson administration, by the Nixon administration, essentially by the Ford administration. Is that possible in the way Russia is organized today, that the dissent would lead to the Duma or the Kremlin changing its direction?
Well, I don't think, I mean, Putin cannot fundamentally change direction. He's tied himself completely to this. The question is whether the Russian establishment finally collectively feels that he has become too much of a liability for them and move to, I doubt a coup as such, but basically, you know, a delegation of top people going to him and others particularly closely associated with this war, like Shoigu, and basically saying, look, you know, we will protect your property, you won't be charged or prosecuted, but it's time to go and, you know, hand over power to somebody who may be able to get us out of this mess. Possibly, I mean, a little bit like the way that Putin took over from Yeltsin. Then, of course, Putin has really run ever since on blaming Yeltsin for the economic disasters and the weakness and the chaos of the 1990s, but at the same time kept his promise not to prosecute Yeltsin, you know, or to confiscate his family's extensive assets. So I think that that it could be, you know, that is the way it will go. But it should be said that it may be now, given that they have failed so badly, and after this latest successful Ukrainian offensive, that Putin and the establishment would now like a peace settlement in Ukraine. And something that the Western media has not latched onto, but they should, is the fact that in this speech, Putin made a positive reference to the Ukrainian peace proposals of March, which, according to the Russians, were blocked by the West. It's not clear exactly what happened, but that is an indication that Putin may be ready for a compromise. But of course, he is going to need something that he can present to the Russian people as at least a qualified success. But that, by the way, will also be true of any successor of Putin. I mean, no Russian government can simply surrender in Ukraine and hope to survive. So I do get the feeling that they, you know, that they would now like a peace if they can get it on, you know, on terms that allow them to pretend that it's...
Also in Putin's speech was a reference to the Luhansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia oblasts for a referenda across the scale to position them as Mother Russia itself. If that goes forward, what are the results of those votes? Is that significant in terms of this peace offering that may be on the table?
Well, it's absolutely critical. Not the votes themselves, because I think we all know what the result will be, you know, under Russian military occupation and organized by Russia. I mean, you know, the only question is whether they'll pretend, you know, to a facade of a fair vote and it will be a 70% majority or whether it'll be a 99% majority. Anyway, I mean, these are, of course, totally fake. But there will be a vote for these occupied regions to join Russia. But the really critical question is, does Putin, and then obviously the Russian parliament on orders, then actually annex these areas to Russia as they annex Crimea in 2014? Because if they do, they have ruled out a peace settlement. They haven't, you know, ruled out possibly a ceasefire at some stage, but, you know, no Ukrainian government, no Western government will ever accept, you know, the annexation of these territories to Russia. It just cannot be. But I think we need to remember that the Donbass republics, separatist republics, declared independence in 2014. But Russia did not recognize that independence until the eve of war this year, in February 8 years later. And in the meantime, Russia actually negotiated through the Minsk process for those areas to return to Ukraine, but with a promise of full autonomy in a process, an agreement brokered by France and Germany. So you see, what I'm saying is that the referenda themselves, do not mark the end of peace. The question is whether Russia actually formally annexes the area. Mm-hmm. Areas. If it doesn't, if it just, notes the results but doesn't do anything with them, then what that would indicate is that this is another bargaining counter. What Russia is willing to, return to the negotiating table, but will now say, well, but in any negotiations, in any settlement, we must take account of the wishes of the local people. But you see the difference. Outright annexation is the end of peace. Just having the votes, it is a move on the, on the diplomatic chessboard.
The mention again of nuclear weapons. You have commented that that is very unlikely, given that it would damage permanently the Russian people, the Russian homeland. However, why does Putin continue to mention it? What is that part of his thinking to oblige, to push NATO to make a decision? Is he looking to provoke NATO to make a mistake?
Well, I mean, the thing is, given the failures of the Russian army on the ground, there are only two things that Putin can frighten us with. And one is obviously, energy, gas, pressure on energy supplies and prices, and the threat of recession in the West. And the other is nuclear weapons. He doesn't have anything else that he can frighten us with. Of course, he's not exactly threatening to use nuclear weapons. There is also, after all, a serious, a real concern that without deliberate intention on either side, as in the Cuban Missile Crisis, that this conflict could escalate through a series of mistakes into nuclear catastrophe. So, but by continually mentioning nuclear weapons, he's basically trying to scare us, to scare the West into negotiations on a peace on at least some of Russia's terms.
I'm paying attention, Anatole, because you and I are well informed about how Khrushchev didn't intend to use nuclear weapons either, and things get out of control when you're coordinating over a long time how the frontline forces are dealing with tactical nuclear weapons, where they're deployed, who has command authority. That happened in 62, and it's not impossible to imagine a scenario it happening again where both sides are concerned that the other side is escalating.
Well, absolutely. And then, that after all is why the Biden administration, did not declare a no-fly zone and send U.S. planes. Because, at that point, you've got U.S. planes being brought down by Russian anti-aircraft batteries, based on Russian soil. Russia, firing missiles into Poland at U.S. air bases. And, once you've got two nuclear superpowers firing missiles into each other's territory, we're closer to the brink than we were, in the Cuban Missile Crisis. So, this is still something to be taken very seriously.
Let's turn to the European Union, because it is part of the fight that the European Union faces a bleak winter, 23, 24, 25. Anatole Levin, visiting in the United States. Welcome to the USA, Anatole, of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. When we come back, recession in Europe and already anxiety about getting through one winter, let alone three, without adequate resources. This is CBSi in the World. I'm John Batchelor.